And we're live!
Hello and welcome back to another transparent episode of the First Time Watchers podcast.
Because we like to watch!
My name is Tim Costa.
This is Walter Vinci.
And those crickets you hear is probably the sound of a million Canadians fleeing their homeland as Romano da Silva enters their country. It seems like he's trying to get into some Toronto International Film Festival.
He's doing some of the tips.
Right. He's visiting there on vacation right now, but since he's right next to TIFF, hopefully he'll be able to provide some feedback and some insight next week.
We're waiting on our roving reporter, see if he comes back with any sort of goodies for us at the moment. And whatever he gets to us, we will give to you.
Absolutely.
The people.
What we'd like to do on the FTW podcast is find a movie that none of us have seen, watch it together, and then discuss. These movies could be new, they could be old, or something that is on all of our lists of shame. And if you'd like to send feedback, remember to email us at firsttimewatchers@gmail.com and stay tuned to the end of this episode for other ways to contact us and to find out what we'll be discussing next week. Speaking of feedback, a few things. First, we had feedback on our Kill List episode.
Awesome.
That was a bonus episode we released. Neil Ramji responded by saying, "Love to the Kill List podcast. Walter's anger amuses me so much. He secretly loves how it annoyed him so much."
No. No.
You don't even appreciate how much it pissed him off?
No, I hate that movie. I hate it.
That's funny. Second, in response to one of our posts promoting our last episode in which we reviewed Lars and the Real Girl, Andy on Twitter, at astimpson99, he said, "Creepiest movie. Love Gosling, but I don't understand the love for this movie." That's an odd response, don't you think?
Well, it's not a bad movie. It's well put together. It's well shot. It's well acted.
But I mean, his response by saying it's a really creepy movie.
I think it's only creepy because the doll is kind of a creepy plot device.
Yeah.
So you have this thing that's obviously not alive. Someone's interacting with it. Like, it would be alive. And, like, I guess the only thing you could think of would be, like, first thing that comes to mind is Psycho.
Psycho?
Yeah. So you have Anthony Perkins interacting with his dead mother, who's off camera, you know,
huh.
Like he's talking. He's like, "What was that, mother?"
Oh, when that's, you know, that's an interesting.
I could draw that line for creepy.
I would have never drawn that comparison. That's a very interesting comparison.
That's why I'm on the show.
One of your uses, at least. And lastly, I'd like to mention that we have a new partner in crime. Simon Opitz, better known as Vex Poet on Twitter, is now a weekly contributor with us. He's going to be submitting written reviews on our Blogspot page, and Simon will be writing reviews on films that we either have not discussed at all or in a long time. His first review with us was regarding The Spectacular Now.
Yeah.
He is a big fan and definitely recommends everyone see it. And this past week's review was a Serbian film.
Oh, I gotta read this.
Walter, I'm sure you remember that movie. And what he had to write actually was very much in line with what you had originally said about the film.
Interesting.
Regarding...
I gotta read his review.
Yeah.
Where can we find his review, too?
So if you visit firsttimewatchers.blogspot.com, you can read his reviews there. And we would love everyone's feedback on Simon's reviews. You can respond to us. You can tweet Simon at VexPoet, or you can leave a comment on the Blogspot page. Once again, that's firsttimewatchers.blogspot.com.
We love feedback. We love interacting with you. We love talking with you. So, you know, talk to us, and we'll talk right back.
In this episode, we will be discussing the 1933 classic The Invisible Man. But before we get into that, it is time for Yay or Nay.
Yay!
This is the part of the show where we discuss what we have seen recently on our own. I will go first. I have three films to talk about. The first one is I rewatched Argo. It was on HBO this past weekend, and it's the first time I'd seen it since we all saw it in the theater.
I think I saw a tweet of this from you.
I posted it on Facebook.
Oh, that's what it was.
On second viewing, my reaction is that it doesn't hold up as much as the first viewing, but it's still a very strong film. Best Picture, though? No.
But my next question would be, is it award-worthy on second
viewing? I mean, not when you put... Of course, my number one film of the year last year was Zero Dark Thirty, And that, I think, is more deserving than Argo of Best Picture. I could even see an argument for Life of Pi being
it was my number one pick of last year.
More worthy. But with Argo, one thing I did notice again is how tight this film is. It really breezes along by. It's right at 2 hours long, and it is a very...
It doesn't feel like a two-hour-long movie.
It's a very brisk film. However, I was actually a little bit more interested in this viewing on the Canadians. No, not the Canadians. Obviously, they pretended to be Canadians, but the people that were stuck in the Canadian ambassador's house.
Yes.
I was more interested in their story of I would have liked more of how they got there, like how they got their position, how their stay in that house. And
you want more backstory?
Not more backstory, but their stay in the house. Obviously, more focused on Affleck's character, Tony Mendez. It was more his story and his plan to exfiltrate them out. But I really would have liked a little bit more in depth of how those members, like six or seven people in the house really felt, and the tension that they felt on a daily basis. And I just wonder, also they focus briefly on the maid of the house, and supposedly, you know, like she was figuring stuff out, but they never really
give you much of that.
No,
it's really like a snippet.
Right, and then later on in the film, they show like some Iranian police officer or whatever, official,
like
security
guard,
interacting with the female head of the household and wondering, you know, questioning her as to how long they've been there and all
yeah.
that kind of stuff. So I just wish I got a little bit more. I think if there was more of that, I think it would have been even more of a compelling film. Once again, the ending of the film, way too manipulative.
But I did not like the way the movie ended.
I remember when this film came out, I was arguing with somebody on Twitter because his only argument to that was that, hey, film is manipulation. Movies are manipulative inherently. And I'm like, well, that's such a weak argument because it's how much you manipulate, you know?
Well, yeah, you also have the really contrived ending with the shooting of the glass to get out there. The movie would have been so much better served if it was just the tension at the checkpoint where they're verifying,
yeah,
and then they get on the plane and they leave.
Right.
Didn't need the chase with the guns.
I remember Hamato saying at one point, all they needed was a flat tire, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that was missing, because they threw the kitchen sink at you is to building up that tension and having problem after problem going on, you know, Alan Arkin and John Goodman almost not making a time to the phone ring. You know, the computer not picking up the ticket right at the first time. And
yeah.
all that kind of stuff just piles onto one another. It's like, Jesus Christ, really? Let's get it moving. But, I mean, it's still a very fine film. It's a very entertaining film. It's just, very... it's like a popcorn film, essentially.
Yeah. Would you say it's nomination worthy?
Well, when you have 10 nominations, the films, yes. I think if you had kept it down to 5, it would have been tough to make an argument for 5.
All right.
But for 10, then yes. Either way, it's still a yay film. If you haven't checked it out, it's definitely worth a check. Second, movie that's been on my list of shame. It just came off of Netflix Instant. Once again, that's why I watched it. An American Werewolf in London.
I haven't seen this movie in ages.
Yeah, I have never seen this film, and I love this film.
This
film is tremendous. It's amazing how well it balances the horror and the comedy. It's a true horror comedy.
Yep.
And the opening scene of them walking through the town and and then coming upon the pub of the locals, you know,
yep.
and then walking away again. The cinematography, the camera work in that is amazing. There's so many good tracking shots that just work so well with their movements, the way they walk, and it really adds to the tension and the comedy. And then later on, after what happens, you know, and one of them survives, he sees his dead friend, you know, in various states of decay throughout the film, you know, and it's a really interesting idea of having, you know, not people, you know, who are mauled by a werewolf becoming a werewolf, but if they die, then they're actually held in limbo, essentially,
yep.
and they haunt the people that they've known or whatever. It's really
From what I remember of this movie, the practicals are pretty awesome too.
Rick Baker, okay, that's one thing too. Rick Baker did the effects for this, and of course he's well known practical effects artist. He also did the effects for the Thriller a music video, and they did not have a makeup effects award for Oscar award until this movie. When this movie came out, they created the award.
They had to,
and they even gave an honorary award to some special effect, you know, makeup effect person from the '60s, you know, and at that time as well. It really obviously showed a leap forward in practical and makeup effects.
I actually saw the actual practicals on display at the Museum of TV and Film in Queens, New York.
Huh.
It's in a display case, and you can see how it all looks like up close.
Nice.
And like they had like shots, like stills of the movie next to it. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and with the practicals at that time, it came out in 1981. You have to edit it in a certain way in order for everything to remain believable, and they do a great job of editing it, you know, and just. Especially there's a final attack scene in London, which turns insane.
Yes.
It is balls out insane. And John Landis also directed Blues Brothers, and car chases and cars crashing into one another, because the ending of this, there's so many cars crashing in the middle of Trafalgar Square or whatever, Trafalgar Square, and it's just insane what happens and how many people get run over, and oh my god, it is pretty crazy. But then, and the soundtrack is inspired, the choice songs.
Yes, like Baton Rising.
Right, and Blue Moon, and they even end it on Blue Moon, and it's a real sharp cut ending to this film. It really takes you for a loop, it really just got me on the right mood. So I mean, yeah, I would recommend this one. This is a yay. And finally, I saw the first movie in a trilogy, in which the third movie in the trilogy came out earlier this year. And when that movie, when this third movie came out, people were saying this is one of the best trilogies of all time. And after seeing the first movie in this trilogy, which came out in 1995, I have to agree already, without having seen the final two, that this is already one of the best trilogies of all time. This is Before Sunrise.
I saw you talking about this on Twitter. With that
starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. I have never seen a movie show the act of falling in love in such an authentic and amazing way. Now, you know, for a number of years, I've heard about this movie and people saying it's a great movie. And the topic, I'm like, oh, I'm not interested. You know, I'm not interested. And then, of course, when the third movie came out, a lot of people were revisiting the entire trilogy and exclaiming about it again. I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. I'm open to just about everything, you know. And, you know, this is a type of movie that in my younger years, I would have stayed away from. I would have been like, I have no interest in this. At this stage of my life, like I said, I'm open to anything. And this movie, as cheesy as it may sound, the synopsis: a young man and woman meet on a train in Europe and wind up spending one romantic evening together in Vienna. Unfortunately, both know that this will probably be their only night together. So they are both very aware that you know, he has to leave at 9:30 for a flight back to America. He had just broken up with his girlfriend, who was spending time in France, I think, or Spain. And then he went for a couple of weeks traveling across Europe. And it's his last day there that he meets Julie Delpy on the train by happenstance. And they start talking. And that really is what the entire movie is them walking and talking. There is some amazing long takes in this, of them just having a discussion. Their chemistry is by far some of the best chemistry between a couple I've ever seen on film. Interaction, the script. I mean, I can't imagine what the script would have been like if there was any improvisation or anything like that. Richard Linklater directed this, and he wrote it as well. Also, a really sad note on the trivia of this is the idea for the movie came one night when Linklater spent a night walking around Philadelphia with a woman he met. And they stayed in touch for a while, but contact was lost. And he hadn't heard from her, you know, for a long time, and then for many years. And he found, when he found out that Amy had died, that girl he had talked to, had died in a traffic accident a few years after they met. You know, so he had tried to obviously reconnect with this person and realized that she had passed away. Just that is what spawned the idea of this film. It's really sad.
Yeah.
But this is one of the most uplifting movies when it comes to relationships. I swear to God, it's just such an amazing. This is a List of Shame movie for anybody, for everybody.
I'll put on my List of Shame for you, Tim. How about that? I've never seen Before Sunrise, or was the other one Before Sunset.
And then the third one is Before Midnight. Yeah. And I had been waiting for this DVD to come in for months because it had been a long wait. And I'm just so happy that I finally got a chance to see it. It is such a tremendous, tremendous film. That is the highest of VAs I could give right now.
Fantastic.
Walter?
Alright, I actually have two movies I want to discuss.
Okay.
The first is a movie that is, I can pretty much give you a nod that this is probably going to be on my top 10 of the year.
Really?
Yeah.
It's not something that came out 20, 30, 40 years ago?
No.
You're not cheating again?
I'm not cheating again.
Okay.
This is Wong Kar-wai's The Grandmaster.
Oh!
The story of Ip Man, which is very embellished.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of beautiful visuals. And the opening scene in this movie, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this. And I'm watching it, because, like, the first opening fight scene, it's Ip Man against a bunch of, like, guys, and then they're in this, like, they're gated in, and it's raining. And, like, the shots of them fighting in the rain are pretty cool, but then when it gets to the actual fight scene, it gets really muddled at the beginning.
Hmm.
Like, it's hard to see what's going on. You see, like a punch, and then, like, you know, a bunch of guys go flying, you know, on wires. But even though that it's, you can't really see what's going on, it is just a treat for the eyes to look at. This, like, focuses in at one point on just the water pooling as this fight's going on, and it's done in slow-mo, so you see, like, the individual beads of water hitting, like, the ground, and, like, their clothing as they go about fighting, and it's kind of like a bit of a, like, a backstory, like, something else that, you know, that supposedly, I don't know how much truth is actually behind this. You know, Ip Man's a pretty legendary character. I've seen a number of movies with, about him. Most recently was with Donnie Yen, which I really love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So the martial arts fighting in this is pretty awesome. Some of the set pieces, they talk about how, like, the masters of Kung Fu would meet in a brothel. And when he's going to challenge another master later, he's like walking level and level, like through this brothel, going up a level and then meeting, like, the master of Hungar, the master of another martial art, master of another, and they're like sparring with him and giving him tips as he goes along. So, like, expect this. Like, this master has mastered all of the northern and southern fighting styles. He's, like, incredibly, you know, powerful and all that. And I loved this movie. For a movie that I was like, at first I was like, I don't know if I might have just wasted money seeing this.
I've heard a lot of compliments on the editing and the cinematography during the fight scenes.
It's beautiful.
I guess so. There's a lot of focus on the feet.
In the very beginning, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Later on, you can see more of the action pieces and stuff like that. And some of the fight scenes are pretty kick-ass, actually.
Cool.
So this is a yay all the way. And I also watched a Nicholas Winding Refn movie.
Oh.
And damn, this guy's gonna make my top 10 of, like, all-time directors. The more work I see of his, the more I am in love with this man. I watched Bronson.
Oh, shit, yeah!
I've never seen, and I watched it. Actually, I watched it last night. And, fuck, I love this movie.
How awesome is Tom Hardy in this movie?
Tom Hardy is fantastic. At first, I was a little mad that my DVD didn't have subtitles.
Oh, yeah.
Because his thing, and he grumbles when he talks.
Yeah.
So I was like, what did he say? So I'm like kind of guessing what's being said. But Tom Hardy is just a joy to watch in this movie. His body acting.
A lot of Tom Hardy schlong.
Not as much as you think.
Well.
I was told about this, like a lot of Tom Hardy, little Tom Hardy there.
Little Tom Hardy.
And not as really much as you think, but his body acting is crazy good.
It's crazy.
Because like this, like my favorite part is the part where he's pouring tea, and he's like in these weird, like he's like half hunched over, and his robes are very red. He's like, "Would you like some tea, you know, governor?" And he pours some tea for the one. I'm like, and you're expecting it to go like bat crazy.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, he's gonna start a fight. And then the next guy comes over, and he's still in that weird kind of, like, 1930s, like, hunched over, like, double fist, but he's pouring tea, and, like, his walk when he's, like, walking through the prison on his one of his release dates, he's got this really odd walk that he's going, and he sticks with this walk the entire time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know what he's doing, or if this is what the real Bronson is like, but I know I like it.
Yeah, I know, huh?
I do have to say that this movie left me it says it's supposed to be like a kind of a loose biopic.
Yeah.
I would say this is a dark comedy.
Maybe both?
It's probably both.
Yeah.
I felt more of the dark comedy, like, aspect.
Sure.
Especially when he's interacting with the imaginary audience.
Yeah. Because that's what he is. He's just a showman.
Yeah. And he's, you know, talking to this imaginary audience. And it's awesome. And, like, I guess, you know, since we live in America, like, it just, some of the things that happen to him in the movie, I think are just really excessive.
So here's a piece of trivia. The line, "It was absolute madness at its very best," was written by Charles Bronson himself for the film and told to Refn during one of their phone calls.
Because Refn's not allowed into the prison because he's not British.
Okay.
Tom Hardy was able to meet with him while they were making the movie. In fact, Bronson shaved off his mustache so that they could turn it into an appliance to put on Tom Hardy. Because he was impressed with how his physique looked.
Interesting. Jason Statham was originally asked to play Charles Bronson, but scheduling conflicts avoided him from appearing in this film. That's probably for the better.
I would say it's for the better. Yeah. I'm a Jason Statham fan. I'm also a Tom Hardy fan. This movie just raises him up.
Tom Hardy's a better actor.
Yeah. And he delivers in this. Every time you see him, he's just awesome to see. I did feel like a little, like when you see like some of the shots in the movie, you see like the aftermath of a Tom Hardy fight, a Bronson fight, and just how badly he's beaten up by the guards, it will make you kind of angry because it's like why would you, like, you've already subdued him, like, what's the point in beating him up some more and then putting him in this, like, crazy, like, little tiny cage?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this, like that's real excessive, but maybe because, like, I've never, A, been in prisons, I don't know what it's really like, so I can't speak for prison guards and, you know, or anything like that. But it's also, too, like, you're living in America, you're like, you expect fair and just, you know, treatment, even if you're in prison, and you see just how, like, brutal it can get. And so Bronson's definitely a yay.
Charles Bronson was not allowed to see the film, but said if his mother liked it, that would be enough for him. According to Refn, his mother loved it. In 2011, Bronson was finally allowed to see the film and called it theatrical, creative, and brilliant.
I can only imagine this guy's like in real life.
I know, huh?
I just would want to stay out of arm's length.
yeah, probably. Yeah, that's exactly what this movie is. It probably is Refn's most theatrical movie. You
know? Yeah, I mean,
it's all what it's about. It's about this man putting on a performance.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing the next three installments of the Pusher trilogy, and then I will be all caught up.
That'll be something. I want to take this time to mention that we now have a YouTube page.
YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube. That's YouTube.
MyTube?
No, YouTube.
That's not proper English.
We have
You exclamation point, tube exclamation point, you tube! Like you're telling me to tube something?
May I continue?
Yes.
Thank
you. Just want some clarification.
We have a little bit of content on it now, and we'll be adding content very soon, such as...
There's a very special, very special treat that you will be getting at the end of... one of our next podcasts that will be going up on the YouTube page.
If you visit youtube.com/1sttimewatchers, you'll be able to see behind-the-show content, in-show content, and maybe some extras, like Wally just mentioned, that each of us would like to share. Once again, that is youtube.com/1sttimewatchers, just another way to enjoy the show. All right, now it's time for Trailer Hitches. This is the part of the show that gives us an opportunity to mention a trailer that either gets us on board for an upcoming movie or makes us want a bitch. I will go first. I will talk about a remake that's coming out in 2014. And probably the biggest reason, the only, I'd say the biggest reason that I would want to see this is its main star, Joel Kinnaman. Joel Kinnaman, who is the lead in this movie, is also a lead in the AMC television show that just got canceled for the second time, The Killing. Okay. And in the third season of The Killing, he did such a phenomenal job. And even in the other two seasons, he did a great job. But I just really am now wanting to see where he goes from here. You know, I want to see more stuff with him. And he just happened to be cast as a lead in the RoboCop remake. This one is directed by Jose Padilla, who is known for, I think it's a Brazilian film, Elite Squad, and the sequel, Elite Squad, The Enemy Within, both of which I think are, especially the first one, which is very highly regarded. So, you know, it's funny enough, this is the second of a Paul Verhoeven movie to be remade recently.
That's right, Total Recall.
Total Recall, which we reviewed, we did a Recall remake episode, and we'll probably be doing the same with this movie as well. It comes out in February. Now, the trailer, I have to say, the trailer is cut in an interesting way, and it makes you believe that it may be a commentary on the use of drones and drone strikes, because it looks like there's a flying machine, a flying drone.
Yeah, something with an airplane of some kind.
Yeah, small aircraft of some sort. And then, of course, there looks like an updated Ed 209. The thing that I like about the updated Ed 209 is that it still maintains the basic shape of the Ed 209 that we know and love from the first movie. The only question is, will it squeal like a pig when it goes on its back?
I hope not.
But also, it looks like there may be some actual robots, too. But, you know, this is a PG-13 film. So, obviously, you're not going to have near amount the gore that Paul Verhoeven's did. I mean, Paul Verhoeven, you know, had an X rating movie, and he had a cut in order to make a rated R.
But Paul Verhoeven, you see RoboCop get impaled with a metal bar and then worked it back and forth.
Yeah, but even before that, oh my god, have you ever seen the unrated version?
I had the Steelbox version. I don't know if the unrated version's on that. Let's see.
It is brutal. It is one of the most brutally violent films I've ever seen. And obviously, this movie won't be able to come up with that. But maybe that's not the point. Maybe with the PG-13, they'll go in a different direction. Obviously, the first one was very satirical.
Yes.
And it had, you know, a theme of government corruption and all that kind of stuff. And also
the power of science.
No, not the power of science, but the power of corporations. And because obviously a corporation is taking over Detroit, you know, rebuilding Detroit, which is eerily, you know, prescient right now. but anyways, in this remake, you know, the trailer, you know, I like Michael Keaton in the trailer. It's pretty cool to see Michael Keaton and what is going on with Samuel L. Jackson. But whatever, you know, we've seen him in crazy roles before, too. I think what I really come away with is just I really want to see Joel Kinnaman get, you know, be a star of some sort, you know. Hopefully he can play the role. That's one thing. It's a little weird to see it. It seems like he's very self-aware of him being rebuilt as a half-man, half-machine.
Yeah, that part of the film I can't get behind.
Yeah, but maybe it's just a glitch of some sort. I don't know. I like that they have the nod to the original suit, because it looks like there's two types of suits that he's wearing, maybe a prototype, and then they refine it.
Yeah, because like, I think the trailer says, like, make it black.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, like, the black version.
Yeah. Well, maybe, you know, I like that. If you're updating a movie, fine, as long as you have nods to the original, that's cool. So, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm tentatively hitching to this, only because of my bias towards Joel Kinnaman, and maybe that's just it.
This is going to take a lot of convincing, because I am very biased to my original.
Oh, sure. I love the first one as well. But
Well, all right, I got the. I saw two trailers that I was debating talking about, so I'll let you choose. But I want to talk about the silly one or the more serious one.
Oh, let's do the silly one.
Atlantic Rim.
Oh, Jesus.
So the guys over. I posted this on Twitter a while back. I believe with the line about, well, that didn't take long. It looks like it's just straight up retelling of Pacific Rim.
It's an asylum film,
but in the Atlantic Ocean this time. Just as bad, you know, terrible CGI. It looks like terrible set pieces, terrible acting. But I have a feeling this is going to be a good time, and I will end up owning this movie along with Sharknado once it comes out, because I collect all the Asylum movies as they get released on DVD.
So the star of this, I love the top billed cast on IMDb, Graham Greene, best known as one of the cops, like the Native American cop in Die Hard 3.
Jesus.
Yeah. So what about the trailer? Did you see that was like,
there's nothing really to really of note other than the fact that it's like, yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. Monsters coming out of the water, attacking the, in New York, and people in robot suits fighting them. It's the same thing, but I want to see what happens when you take a movie like Pacific Rim and then take away all its money.
Well, I mean, you get Transmorphers. That's what you get. And Transmorphers is not good.
No, it's not. But this one might be fun. They might have learned their lesson.
You always have hope for an asylum film, don't you?
I always do. So I'm going to hitch because it's just a silly thing to hitch to. I want to see what it's like when you do Pacific Rim with $0.
All right, now I'm really curious. What was your more serious one?
Mandela, The Long Walk to Freedom.
All right, talk about this one.
Starring Idris Elba. There was parts of...
Oh, wait. You mean the next James Bond?
No. There's parts of Mandela's... I don't really know the man's entire backstory.
Sure.
But this trailer fascinated me from the beginning. I'm like... Never thought, like... I never occurred to me that, like, Mandela might have been, at one point, kind of an extremist. Because you see him building bombs in the movie and using explosives to try to win freedom. And I was like, you know, I never thought of that. Like, you always think of Mandela being this, you know, man of peace and, you know, civil unrest and, you know, passive disobedience and all that stuff. And it looks like there's a whole other side that I wasn't aware of. And I want to see this other side. Elba is a fantastic actor. I love seeing him in things. I don't think he's going to be the next James Bond. But this movie looks fantastic. I want to see this backstory. And... I believe it comes out later on this year, I think.
October 19th, I think.
Yeah, so it comes out shortly.
Yeah.
And, I'm hitching it. I'm totally hitching to this because I will see it.
Naomi Harris plays Winnie Mandela. She's a good actress. The director is Justin Chadwick. I'm trying to see what he's known for as a director. He has 20 directing things under his belt, some TV. But last thing of note was The Other Boleyn Girl. A lot of TV here. It looks like British TV. So, yeah.
I'm hitching.
Yeah, I haven't seen this trailer. I'm curious, especially with Idris Elba as the lead. And of course, I'm sure any story told well of Nelson Mandela is a good, inspiring one.
And I want to see this backstory.
Yeah. Guess what, Wally?
What, Tim?
We have merchandise available for purchase.
What?
Yes.
What do we have?
You can get t-shirts and more if you visit Zazzle.com/first-time-watchers.
T-shirts, you say?
T-shirts.
And more?
Yes. We even have an updated logo, which I'm sure you'll be able to soon have as a t-shirt.
That work of art. That is our logo.
Yes. In the future, you'll be able to purchase just about anything with our logo on it.
Yes.
Okay.
Anything I can possibly put our little logo shilling hands on.
So please show your support of the show by visiting Zazzle.com/first-time-watchers and find an item that you'll be proud to wear. Once again, that's Zazzle.com/first-time-watchers. Okay, let's talk about The Invisible Man.
He's gone mad. You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? All right, I'll show you.
The plot. A scientist finds a way of becoming invisible, but in doing so, he becomes murderously insane, based on the H.G. Wells novel. The director, James Whale. The actors, Claude, this is my first talkie, Rains. Gloria, yes, I'm old Rose from Titanic, Stewart. And Henry, Clarence the Angel from It's a Wonderful Life, Travers. Okay, Walter.
Yes, Tim.
I think this is actually the oldest film that we have seen for the show.
So far.
So, considering it came out in 1933, that would make it 80 years old.
That is correct.
So what was it like to step back in time?
I love this movie. I had a good time watching it.
Yeah.
Clocks in at about an hour and 11 minutes.
That's it.
So it's not a heck of a lot of investment. It's no Kill List, to tell you the truth. I've always loved the look of The Invisible Man from 1933. I love the face swathed in bandages with the big dark goggles and the high collar trench coat. That always screams creepy as hell to me, like to see that. I've seen a number of posters of it. Don't ever recall seeing the movie actually, but I've seen it in clips. It's been all over the place.
Yeah.
It was really cool for me too to see the special effects of invisibility.
Sure.
Because back in the day, the only way I can think of, I have to do some research on this, make sure I'm not talking on my ass. But the only way I can think of doing it is you shoot a clean plate, shoot your actor, and then duplicate that clean plate and carefully cut out each part you want transparent, and then reprocess that those entire three lengths of film.
In order to achieve the effect that Claude Rains wasn't there when his character took off his bandages, the director had Rains dressed completely in black velvet and filmed him in front of a black velvet background. So that's one process of it, it was probably more in the post-production.
Yeah, but, I mean, the effects of this are actually really cool. For 1933,
oh, sure.
to see a shirt running around with nothing in it, and it doesn't look half bad.
No, it doesn't.
Even watching it on, a high-def screen, I watch it on an iPad, seeing it, it's pretty freaking cool. You know what I mean? I think this movie suffers from overacting from the side characters.
Okay, so that's the thing too, because considering 1933, this is 4 years after the invention of sound in the film.
Yes.
And so it was silent film. You had a lot of people who were actors, they had to emote very broadly. They had to over-emote in order to get their performances across without any sound. And also, I'm sure a lot of these people had stage acting as well, which they had to do the same thing,
Some of it was really distracting. The lady in the tavern.
Oh. She was the most annoying.
I wanted her out of my movie as quickly as possible.
The screams?
The screams, the wail. I mean, I can understand, we now have to bring sound, we need to overdo it.
Yeah.
But, she takes it to, a level that is just... I can't really describe it.
Yeah.
Claude Rains is the villain. I loved his villainy voice
when
he's invisible, and his temper tantrums. I love all that. That's a classic villain to me. And this was just it was a nice treat to kind of sit back and, this is how they used to do it back in the day, I'm gonna tell you.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It took a little while for this movie to grow on me, and as the couple of days has gone by, I've really grown to appreciate it a little bit more. This movie is insane. It's balls out insane because its main character is literally insane.
Yes.
He does some terrible things.
And it starts right from the get-go.
Well, that's the thing, too. My biggest complaint about this film is how, by the end, they try to make him a tragic figure, but...
No, not that point. It's too late.
No. There's no point where I knew him before this.
Yes.
I always expected him... The film to go back in time and show him transforming himself, but no, they never did that. And at an hour and 11 minutes, obviously they could have added more, plenty of time in order to be able to do that. Because it opens right on the snowstorm. He's walking through the snowstorm trying to find an inn, And I'm like, at this point, oh, okay, we're at this point in the story. I kept expecting this movie to go back in time and show him, but no, they only reference it through monologues, and I don't know, maybe it was the way the technique was at that time, the filmmaking was at that time, but I'm sure we could find there were plenty of movies at that time that were longer than this.
Yeah.
Even silent films.
Gone with the Wind longer than this?
Well, Gone with the Wind came out 6 years later.
Oh,
and that's almost 4 hours long. But that I think this decade shows a certain evolution, which you saw with The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, in the final jump into the next evolution of film, you know. But this is still very early on in the talkies, if you will, you know. So, and Claude Rains, this is his first talkie. He had only one silent film under his belt prior to this, and he was like a professor, a an acting teacher. So to see him in his first real true role, essentially, is really amazing. Just the voice, the well enunciated words and rolling of the R's, and they did a good job with the camera of always when he's like plotting out his deviousness that he wants to do in the future. The camera's underneath him in almost like a godlike position. And
I know what I will do next. Yeah. I will do this.
Yes, and I felt so bad for the guy that he's roping this into, because he's a complete weakling. You know,
yes.
But obviously, I mean, he's very Claude Rains' character. He's very strong. Did the serum give him superpower as well? Because he beats on everybody and everything, you know?
He even calls it out when he's, like, threatening. He's like, I'm very strong, and I will choke you as you sleep.
Yeah, there's a scene early on in this film which was, like, really odd to me, where it was obviously, you know, a stage where it pans from one side of, like, a mansion to another and through a room.
And they walk through it, through the door.
Yeah, but you can see
the, where the wall is.
Yeah.
The wall ends.
I was like, what is this? Is this filmed in front of a live studio audience or something? I'm like, what was the point of that?
The lens is too wide. They were shooting with too wide a lens. Because if they just follow it as a track,
oh.
And you would have gotten the divider of the wall to see that he's moving from one
just
room
a blur,
to the, just a blur, and it's like a black bar.
Because in front of that division, there was like a plant.
You can see everything in front of it. The shot's too wide.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense to me. Gloria Stewart, her, there's no need for her to be in this movie.
Well, she's there, I think, because she's telling you, she's the exposition for Claude Rains' character's backstory. He was such a, you know, she's in love with him, so he had to have been a good man at one point.
Yeah,
you know. Then you've got the other side who's like, "Let me tell you how I feel."
Yeah.
Not at this time.
Yeah.
I can't believe you.
Yeah, it's very melodramatic. Yeah, everything is very melodramatic, and like there's even points in there where it really balances that a fine line between true horror in what he is doing and complete and utter slapstick Keystone Cop routines, because there's routines in this where the cops are completely buffoons.
Yes,
you know?
Where he steals, like, one cop's pants and drags him over a wall, and then he's, like, skipping down the street singing.
Yeah, and then the scenes in the bar where, you know, he walks in on the big meeting that the constable is having in order to take people's statements, and, he goes up to get the books and then goes back downstairs, and he just throws the ink into the officer's face, and the woman, the screaming lady again, gets on top of the table and starts screaming even more. And
well, there's also a different sensibility at the time too. Like maybe like throwing the ink in somebody's face might be kind of more miscreant than we would.
Well,
take it
yeah,
now.
But you're right. The sensibilities of what, what are the sensibilities of going between these two, these two genres, essentially, horror and comedy. I don't understand why you need to have this such broad comedy.
Maybe it's because they're still getting their legs underneath them. You know, back in the day when you'd have the mustache twisting.
I don't
know,
because there's plenty of you know, silent films that were able to take it. Like Nosferatu, very early 1922 film, I think.
Yep.
You know, that was a complete straight-out horror film. There's no, and it's a silent film, and it's no comedy in it whatsoever. So the maybe it's just the director and the director's choices.
It might have been.
I don't know. I want to get into spoilers to talk about more of what he does, because what he does is insane, is horrifying.
Well, then let's get into spoilers, shall we?
So this friend that he's, or this co-worker, he has been trying to
Dr. Kemp.
Yeah, he's been trying to, you know, lure into his evil schemes. and he's trapped in his own house, essentially. And once he realizes, you know, that he's ratted him out to the cops and has set a trap for him, he takes his invisible routine and follows him, and he explains to him exactly what he's going to do and exactly how he's going to die.
We'll kill you tomorrow night at the stroke of 10.
Well, that, and then he does that, and he ties him up in a car and sends him over a cliff, you know, but before that, he monologues exactly what's going to happen to him, how he dies, and it is terrifying. I'm at this point, I'm like, is this really going to happen? Because you spent a lot of time with this Kemp figure and thinking, oh, there's some way that he's going to
get out
of this, nope. Or be saved or something.
Nope.
And I'm like, what the fuck? This is horrifying. And then he derails a train with hundreds of people in it?
Well, yeah, that's like, I think they said something that's like not a lot. They don't give you a really big number for the people that's on the train.
There's obviously a lot of people.
There's people on the train, but they say something like it's like 20 people in the movie or something like that.
Oh, I don't know. It sounded like a lot more. It could have been that many, but still.
Because I think the constable's reading is like, oh, he derailed a train with like 20 people on it.
Okay, but even
so. They're like trying to keep it at least a little. We didn't just kill an entire train full of people.
I know, and then he bashes the constable's head in with the end of a table or whatever. And I mean, he does some horrifying, terrible, terrible things. But still, by the end of this film, you're supposed to they turn it where it's supposed he's supposed to be a tragic figure. But there's no
redeeming him.
There's no redeeming him in the viewer's eyes, because he was always bad. They never showed him as good. You know,
and he never gets a chance to become good at the end. You know, I mean, he's not like he is going to save somebody because he's invisible and, you know, he dies in a hail of gunfire at a bank robbery. He's a bad guy from the beginning of the movie all the way to the end.
Yeah, and then also he's, like, traveling through the countryside with just a shirt going, pop goes the weasel, blah-dee-da-dee-da, you know.
Exactly.
Scaring people. But that's, like, borderline comedy, too.
Yeah.
But it's also terrifyingly... like a terrifying madman, you know, who's completely lost his marbles. I mean, the lines that this movie crosses is just insane to me. Insane. Was there anything else about the end that I missed?
Because we finally get to see him at the very end. Finally revealed.
Yes. I mean, that's a cool slow dissolve back to...
It's a layered effect. Cause you see, like, the skull, and you see, like, the face fill up a little bit more, and then it's him.
Yeah.
I was like, 1933.
No, it was the special effects were pretty good for them. Now, I remember watching this back when I only saw like a clip or so of it. I remember walking in, my dad was watching it, and I was like, I don't know, maybe 10 years old or something like that. And I remember it was the scene where he's unwrapping his face, and I looked at my dad. I was like, this is 1933. They had special effects like this back then. Wow! You know, of course, even the wire work was pretty good, because you only saw the wires on a couple occasions.
Yeah.
You know, they really hit it pretty well.
I found cool is that the whole thing takes place in England.
No, that's the thing, though. I couldn't tell, because it was filmed in California.
But the movie is set in England, because everyone's only talking in pounds, shillings.
Oh, were they?
Yeah.
Oh.
And quid.
Yeah, but
they're using all the English terms.
So, there's a lot of people who have an English accent, but there's some people who have no English accent whatsoever.
Even the cops are called bobbies. They refer to them as like,
yeah.
Oh, you know, get them. And all the cops are dressed like British police officers, which is...
You're right.
For a movie shot in California to make it look like Britain...
What's the point? Maybe because that's where it took place in the original novel?
I've never read the original novel, so I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I thought it was kind of a neat little like thing. I picked the ball on that about halfway through the movie. I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything else you want to mention?
No. I think that
I mean, the overall
hour limit is not much we can cover.
Right. The overall performances, though, I mean, like we said, Claude Rains, I think, is pretty damn good.
His voice is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I love the sound of his, you know, I will get him.
Yeah. I think he has to be a little bit more broad physically because he is wrapped in bandages.
Yeah, he's got a gesture. He's got an emote from something where you can't see his face.
Right.
So it's all body language, like,
yeah.
You know, it's grand sweeping gestures.
Everybody else, I think, is very very over the top, very very broad.
Yeah, like what's the name? The woman who plays his like love interest. Like,
oh! Yeah.
Every time you see her.
Yeah. You know, the cinematography, you know, the camera work back then, I think, was pretty cool. There was a special effect of the bike traveling on its own,
yeah.
Which I saw some sort of track on the in the ground, but I really couldn't figure out how they made it move, you know?
Yeah.
I was really curious about that, but, I mean, would you recommend this to people?
If you're a fan of old-school science fiction, old-school horror, you like, you want to see what it was done, what it would look like before, I'd recommend this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is where your Evil Dead's now. That's where this came from.
Sure, I can see that.
You need to go roll the camera back like all the way.
Even Evil Dead 1980 something.
Even then, or even like the Hollow Man.
I thought about that too. I'm like, oh yeah, Paul Verhoeven really fucked it up.
Yeah, exactly. But this is where it was all like stuff like that all originated from, like way back here, and that's pretty cool to be able to go back and say like kind of like, oh, these are your roots, kid. You know, this is where you came from, kid.
Yeah.
Go on, make some movies there.
Great.
I'm gonna give it an A.
An A.
I'm basing it based on the year that it was made. Yeah. You know what I mean, 1933. So like, this movie does a lot for a movie where they didn't have a lot of tech.
I agree. I don't think I would give it that high a grade simply because of the balance that I said it was trying to strike. You know, between humor and horror. I mean, I would go with a B, only because that I was really taken aback by that imbalance almost.
All right, so you're basing more on the technical merit. You're basing it some more on the actual performance merit.
Not the performance, but the writing essentially.
All right.
Yeah.
So what does that average out to?
B plus. Yeah, sounds good. Okay, that does it for this episode of the First Time Watchers podcast. You can find us on Facebook by searching First Time Watchers. We post movie news and updates that we think you would be interested in. And you can email us at firsttimewatchers@gmail.com.
You can talk to us on Twitter at 1sttimewatchers@twitter.com.
And you can also follow us on Tumblr at firsttimewatchers.tumblr.com. And please download our episodes on iTunes and feel free to leave a review. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you have any suggestions of movies for us to watch, send a tweet, an email, or a post on our Facebook page. And stay tuned for our next episode. We'll be discussing the 2003 Nicholas Winding Refn film, Fear X.
That's First Time Watchers Podcast, because we like to watch.
Witness it?
Wally, I'm already getting preemptively mad at you.
For what?
For something that you probably are... Now, I'm thinking you're not going to do it, but now that I'm mentioning it, you're probably going to do it.
Most
just
likely.
To piss me off.
What is it?
In 4 weeks is the finale to Breaking Bad.
Yep.
And you have yet to see a single episode.
Not a thing.
And you're probably going to watch the final episode.
You better.
And you're
going
to be like, holy shit, I need to go see this now. And I'm going to be so fucking pissed at you. Because what you see and your reaction to it will not be earned at all. Exactly like your reaction to the second to last episode of season 3 of Game of Thrones.
Well, see, my reaction to that was not like, holy shit, this is the best thing. I was like, what the... How did we get to this point?
Yeah, but no, that's... That in and of itself made me so upset that you did that, because you cheated yourself.
I cheated myself.
Yes, you did. You cheated yourself of actually watching it and having that moment earned for you, and not be like... oh wow, this is weird. How, just like you said, how did we get to this? See, your reaction would be your reaction would be completely different if you saw it genuinely for the first time after seeing the previous episodes.
I don't know. I mean, like, it's not like
here we go. Do you go and, like, when you get a new comic book or a book, do you go and read the last page, the last paragraph,
no,
the last chapter?
No.
Why not?
Actually, no, I do it literally more. I take a look at the last page every single time.
Of one specific one?
One specific title.
Okay, but
I know,
no,
where
I'm talking about
with
everything that's new to you.
I want to know
do that.
What to expect at the end of this book. And
but
like,
do you
how
do
I
that
there.
With every single thing that's new to you? With a new book? Anything. Do you go to... Do you get a DVD in the mail? Do you go to the last chapter and watch the last 5 minutes and then go back and watch the...
No, but I have watched movies on fast forward.
No, that's not the same thing. You're trying to rationalize this, and it doesn't make any sense, and it pisses me off, and you're going
to
do it with Breaking Bad.
It makes perfect sense to me.
I'll punch you in the face.
It makes perfect. All you hear on the podcast is, ow! Motherfucker, you hit me!
I told you I would.
God. So now this is the record that Tim is going to assault Wally on the show if he watches Breaking Bad. Just want to clarify my legal comeuppance here, just in case that happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, seriously, I mean,
I don't know, I'm never home when it's on, so yeah, it's not like I'm ever going to catch it. And you know, no one I know really watches it anyway. So, I mean, the other people in the house watch, you know, Game of Thrones. I'm like, oh, I'll watch this. I'm like, well, this seems a little crazy.
Well, still, until a month from now, I'm going to be still preemptively mad at you.
Preemptively mad at me?
Yes.
So you're going to be like Phoebe on Friends.
Well,
when she's mad at Ross the entire day because something she dreamt.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. That's exactly what exists. And she doesn't know why.
And she doesn't know why.
Yeah.
She's like, I dreamt that I'm mad at you. But you're mad at me because you dreamt that you were mad at me?
That's a good one.